The DUP leader Arlene Foster and her former special advisor Dr. Andrew Crawford have been giving evidence to the RHI inquiry. Dr. Crawford resigned last year as the row over his role in the botched green energy scheme escalated. He had been accused of trying to keep the scheme open at a time when it was losing public money. He denies that claim. Mrs. Foster, of course, was Minister for the Department of Enterprise when RHI was first introduced. The Newsletter political editor Sam McBride has been following the RHI inquiry closely. So, Sam, what have been the highlights over recent days?
Well, I think yesterday for many people will have been a very significant day, and people who haven't been following this inquiry will have paid much more attention to it because of Arlene Foster's appearance there. There has been an element here where for more than a year, I suppose, Arlene Foster's stock response and quite understandable response to questions about RHI is to say, really, I can't comment about this. It would be inappropriate for me to comment about this. This will be discussed when I come before the inquiry. So that has led to, I suppose, a degree of expectation as to what she will say there, a degree of uncertainty as to whether her position would have changed in any way, and based on the evidence that, has come out to date, best based on circumstances which have changed. And really, I suppose the answer that we got yesterday was that she is very much sticking to her guns on this. She is very clear, very robust in her defence of all of her actions, says that really she made no mistakes, that there is nothing for which she feels she bears personal responsibility or anything which she thinks she could have done differently at the time based on the evidence that she had before her. So that has answered that question. And I suppose over today and next week, as she continues to give evidence in much more detail, we will see individual cases put to her and see what she says in response to very specific actions which either she took or those around her were taking at the time.
Let's walk through some of this. Back to Andrew Crawford then, who was Arlene Foster's special advisor. He addressed the claim, which forced his resignation as a SPAD, that he had tried to keep the RHI scheme open in 2015 at a time when it was losing lots of public money. Let's have a listen.
For people to say at that stage that I was encouraged trying to keep the scheme open runs a contrary to what I was doing and what evidence I can produce to the inquiry and have produced to the inquiry.
So there's an emphatic denial. What he did admit to in his witness statement, Sam, was that he had inappropriately shared confidential government information with two relatives, a cousin and a brother-in-law.
That's right. And on the first of those issues, that is something which the inquiry is not yet coming to look at. So he wasn't really pressed on that issue, but what he said is totally consistent with what he said at the point where he tendered his resignation from his post with Arlene Foster. So on the issue of sending this confidential material to relatives, he sent these ministerial submissions. One was in 2013, one was in 2015. And the 2015 one is particularly significant because it came in July of that year. It came as plans were being put in place to rein in the scheme. So they knew at that point, in terms of the officials, certainly at the very least, I think Andrew Crawford disputes whether he knew this, but there was an understanding within at least part of government that the scheme was seriously out of control. There were serious budgetary issues there, and they realised that there were no cost controls, and cost controls were needed. One of his relatives was a claimant on the scheme. He sent this to him via his private email address. This document made clear the date at which they were planning to introduce cost controls. His brother or his cousin who received that says now that he didn't act on it because although he did install boilers, he did apply to accredit boilers on the scheme after the date when he received that email, he says that he had already put that process in train, so really it didn't make any difference to him. Regardless of whether that is going to be stood up at the inquiry when they come to that in more detail, Andrew Crawford has accepted, as you say, that this was inappropriate behaviour, that he should not have done this. And Arlene Foster, in her written evidence, has said that she thinks he may have broken some of the codes by which he was bound as a government employee. So that is a very significant development, which the inquiry hasn't really come to orally yet. But in writing, those two people have accepted that something went badly wrong there in terms of what he did.
So if Arlene Foster thinks that her former special advisor may have broken codes, those are codes of conduct, presumably, are they?
That's right.
Why didn't she tell us this at the time?
Well,
why not?
It may well be that she will say she didn't know about this at the time. That's that's part of the difficulty with this, that we have a written statement from the two of them, but we have fairly terse answers to both of these questions. It's very clear that both accept something wrong happened or something potentially wrong happened, but we don't have the full picture, so that will be teased out, I think, in considerable detail in the oral evidence where they will be pressed about that.
And then Dr. Crawford, Andrew Crawford, who as we've just been talking about, said that he inappropriately shared this confidential government information with two relatives. We then learn that he's still employed on a part-time basis by the DUP. Let's have a listen.
My main role is, I'm a farmer myself. I have my own farm, small as it may be. I also help in my family dairy business, involved in that. And I do some part-time advisory work for the party, but it's very much part-time, and my main role is on the home farm business.
So we remember back at the time, Sam, that you know, it was very public that Dr. Crawford was stepping away from his road. I think he said, and I'm paraphrasing now, but he didn't want to be a distraction for the party. He was stepping aside on that basis. And then now we learn he's still employed by the DUP.
That's right. And I think that will surprise some people outside the DUP. I think it will also surprise some people within the DUP who weren't aware of that. It was obviously very public at the time when he stepped aside. The idea that he stepped aside as a full-time advisor, but he remained as a part-time advisor, is not something that was certainly publicised in any way, to the best of my knowledge. I think the issue which you were just asking me about there as to what Arlene Foster knew about this inappropriate behaviour, as he describes it, is not quite clear in terms of what happened at the time, but it's certainly clear that today she knows about it. And I think that is where the political question comes to the DUP. I asked them what his role was, whether there'll be any change to that role as a result of what he has admitted. They came back and said that really it's not something they want to comment about because of the ongoing inquiry. But I think that is something which is going to come back to be asked of them at a future point.
And obviously there are restrictions around this inquiry, Sam, and we understand why. That Sir Patrick Coughlin, who's the chair of that inquiry, he wants to make sure that things are decided within an inquiry and that there's not trial by media. And we'll all respect that, and we understand that. It doesn't stop the media, though, doing its job to this extent. We're allowed to talk about this. Here we have a political party in Northern Ireland where there is a special advisor who has now admitted to inappropriately sharing confidential government information with two relatives about one of the biggest scandals that there's been in Northern Ireland for a long time. And that political party today, to April 2018, say, yeah, we're still employing this guy and we're not going to tell you why.
That's right. And I think the significant factor here is that while the inquiry process is very strict about evidence, where evidence is being taken and people are coming in future to give evidence about that, that you don't want that being discussed by those people in public outside the inquiry process. That's not really the case here, because in this case, there is no dispute around whether this was inappropriate. This is behaviour which both Dr. Crawford and Mrs. Foster themselves say was inappropriate. And really, the question mark is more as to what the significance of that was for his relatives. Did it have any material impact? But where the party, it would seem, is accepting that he acted inappropriately, but they continue to employ him, I think that is a very legitimate question, and it's not really anything to do with the inquiry.
And so therefore, let's discuss it. And by the way, our number this morning, 03030 80 55 55. I guess there may be some members of the public who were furious about this scheme, who were furious that the controls were not in place to protect some of their money, and whoever is responsible for that, let's let the inquiry decide that. But at the end of the day, this was a botched scheme. And here, how do you think the public is going to react, Sam, to this revelation now that the DUP, having heard that public anger, they continue to employ a man who has inappropriately shared government information with two of the people in his own family? Like, what's an ordinary member of the public listening to this morning going to make of this?
Well, I think the political value to the DUP of Andrew Crawford resigning when he did last year was really to try to put a bit of a firewall between him and the party. I think that there seemed to be an acceptance that there were going to be very difficult questions. We obviously didn't know the full story, but the party knew more than we did around his role. They didn't want to have that so clearly linked to the party. To a certain extent, that is now significantly undermined by the fact that they have chosen to re-employ him. So any sort of a sense that they were unhappy with what he had done or they thought it was wrong and therefore they acted, it's not really clear if that's still the case. Was there any internal party sanction about this? Was there any internal party process to ask him about this? That's not really clear, but the party are not prepared to discuss that. They say because this is before the inquiry, they don't want to discuss it, and that's that. So
yeah, they don't want to, not that they can't.
Well, I think, I mean, there's probably a bit of a grey area here as to what can and can't be discussed. But I mean, I think it would seem pretty clear that if you're employing someone who, in whatever forum, whether it's a court or anywhere else, has accepted they acted inappropriately, that it's legitimate that you're asked, is it right that you're employing him? Is he being paid public money, for instance? None of that's clear at this point.
Do we know, was he re-employed, Dr. Crawford? Did Arlene Foster decide to re-employ him within the party, or did it never stop? So from the point at which it was being made public, right, Dr. Crawford standing aside, Dr. Crawford's leaving his role, actually, what was going on behind the scenes, was it that he had left the role and he was out of the party, or did the employment actually continue the whole way through?
I think we can answer that question in one regard anyway. He definitely resigned as a special advisor, so there would have to have been some sort of formal process to give him a separate role. So a special advisor is employed technically by the government department for which he works. He's paid out of taxpayers' money. He was paid £85,000 in this case. To give him another role, there would have to have been a conscious decision that he will do something else. I suppose the question is, did that happen immediately, or was there some sort of a break, and will the party try to say that that in its way was some sort of punishment? The second aspect of this is that Dr. Crawford received a very significant golden handshake when he left and when he resigned from his post as a special advisor. So in some ways, I suppose he technically almost continued to be paid for several months after that. I think it was in the region of about £35,000 at that point, which he received. So I suppose the question is, did he in any way suffer for what he says was inappropriate?
Hold on a second. So walk me through that. So Dr. Crawford, when he stood down from, and we now know that part of the reason, presumably, why he was walking away is that he knew that it would become public then, that he had shared at some stage in the future, and now we know that he is sharing confidential government information with two relatives, you know, information that none of the rest of us could get. That information was shared with his relatives because of his privileged position. Are you telling me that he got $35,000 for walking away in those circumstances?
That's right. There was a freedom of information request, which one of my colleagues at the newsletter made last year for all of the special advisors. And I think, to be fair to Dr. Crawford, I think pretty much every one of them received a severance payment. Now, that was for the most part for people who lost their jobs as a result of the executive collapsing. Dr. Crawford obviously resigned about 2 months before the mandate actually ran out last March. But one of the quirks of the system installment, I suppose, is that even when somebody resigns in these circumstances, there is a provision whereby they receive a percentage of their salary. It's based on how long they've been there. It's based on what they were paid. But yes, he received a very significant sum in severance money when he left.
So again, let's bring this back to the working class man or woman going to work this morning, listening to this. So if they do something wrong at work, they're out. And I very much doubt if they do something wrong at work, they get a penny. In this circumstance, Dr. Crawford inappropriately shares government information and the taxpayer throws him $35,000. Am I wrong in one word of that?
I think no, and I think that is the crux of this. That and I think it's why he has admitted that this was inappropriate, because there is no way that you could construct a defence of what he has done here. This is clearly privileged information which people within government have access to, and if you're passing that to anyone, Dr. Crawford is clear that the only people he passed it to were his relatives, But I think there is a large element of that appearing to somebody outside the system as, at the very least, nepotism, where people are benefiting through their family connections to someone in government. That's not the way government is meant to work. Government is meant to be impartial. It is meant to be fair, and they're meant to be acting in the public interest, not in the interest of anyone who is close to them through family ties or anything else.
And then knowing that Dr. Crawford has done this, we don't know at what point, but we certainly know, as you say, at this point this morning, we know that Arlene Foster knows that Dr. Crawford inappropriately shared this confidential government information, and she continues to employ him within her party.
That's right. And I mean, I think if we maybe just go through some more of the detail of this. So the submission that he forwarded to his cousin is Richard Crawford, who is a poultry farmer, who farms just beside him in County Tyrone, I think it is. The submission that he forwarded to him had in the subject line urgent cost controls. So it was pretty explicit. Even if he glanced at it, this was very significant. It made clear that the scheme was in serious financial difficulty. It said that there was going to be a need to urgently implement cost control measures to manage future RHI expenditure. It gave a date of the 1st of October 2015 for when those changes would be made. Actually, we now know that through various delays, which are not quite it's in dispute as to why those delays happened, but the delays in introducing cost controls meant that they didn't come in until the 18th of November. So for another month and a half, there were no cost controls. But he was being given notice that on the 1st of October, this would happen. It was clear to him, because he was somebody who was a claimant on the scheme, so he understood the nature of the payments and how significant they were. He'd already been receiving them for, I think, three boilers at that point, that this was something which was going to be significant to him. He says that he had already been building these sheds, that he had been working on them for months, that the boilers, he thinks, were installed around July of last year, so around the time when he got this email. But he says that the person who installed them didn't put in the paperwork for those until September. So that is going to be one of the significant issues here as to whether there is any evidence further around that as to what actually happened between July, when he received this email from his cousin in government, and September, when he actually, through his agent, I suppose, who was installing these boilers, put in the paperwork saying, I want to apply to join the scheme for these three boilers.
Okay, well, let's move this on to the other aspect which we learnt. One of the other aspects that we learnt from the inquiry, we now hear how Dr. Crawford explained a system where he and Arlene Foster, they would interact with each other through post-it notes.
Arlene and I had a way of working. If I wanted to speak to her about it, and it may be some other issue, what do you think of this or whatever, I would put a post-it note on the submission, and generally it would be, Arlene, give me a call. And that would have stayed on that submission, and when the minister then was reviewing it, she knew there was something obviously that I wanted to talk about, or there was some other issue, and very often when she was going through it, going up the road in the morning, going home in the evening, I would have got a phone call. I'm going through this energy paper. What is it you want to talk about, or what are the issues? And you know, that could be for a multitude of reasons. It could be something I want to clarify. It may be some political dimension to it that I wanted to take her mind on it. It was very often issues that were not really related to the core policy part of the department, but it was our way of... It was my way of interacting with the minister, and bearing in mind we couldn't often do it when the two of us weren't the same. We rarely had time for the two of us together to do it in the same room. That was the way I put the note on it, and she knew then to give me a call rather than signing it off.
There then followed this exchange between the inquiry and the inquiry judge, Sir Patrick Coughlan, Dr. Crawford, and the inquiry counsel, Joseph Aiken, who we will hear from first.
If there was any political advice I wish to provide to the Minister on the context of the submission, I would make a note on a post-it note and attach that to the submission for the Minister's consideration. This system worked for us, as the Minister could consider my advice alongside the submission to which it related and come back to me to discuss further if required. Now, obviously anybody can give any advice they like, verbally, and there's no record of it. Here, slightly different from the answer that you gave to Damuna just a short while ago, the post-it seems to be political advice, politics on a post-it, as it were, that would be added to the submission. Now, were those post-its preserved on the submissions? I'm talking about generally. Forget about RHI. We'll come to it.
No. The post-its were not preserved, but when I refer to politics there, I'm referring to politics probably with a small p, yeah, in terms of managing the process or whatever it happens to be. But you know, and when I put a post-it on the note, or when I put a post-it on it for the minister to give me a call to talk about a submission or whatever, no, they were not recorded.
So can I put it this way, Dr. Crawford, whatever political advice you might have written on the post-its, that was not going to then remain on the submission when the submission was returned to the private office?
No, but if there was something that, you know, politically that was, that after the discussion that the minister would have with me, if there was something politically in relation to the submission, the minister would then have annotated it onto the submission. And that may have been meeting or whatever it happened to be. So it was either discarded or the minister would have followed it up with comments on that submission.
Well, no doubt Mr. Schofield can ask Ms. Foster about the post-its, but what I'm trying to understand is whatever this was that's written on the post-it, it would form part of the decision-making of the minister, even if that is, I need to speak to you about that, and then you speak, whatever it is you speak about, it informs the decision making. Maybe what was on the post-it was a little more elaborate than that, drawing attention to some particular point. I don't know, because I haven't seen any. But is it really the case that they just went to the bin?
I think we're in danger of overcomplicating this process. This was purely a way for me to communicate with the minister to give me a call regarding a submission. You know, the vast majority, or most times, it would have been give me a call regarding this. You know, when we start to talk about, you know, politics and all the rest of it, I think maybe we're going to overcomplicate it too much. That's not the intention of it. It was purely something that I wanted to alert the minister to, and it was our system, so she knew that there was some query I had with the submission, and she wanted to, and for her to contact me about it.
Okay.
But there would be no record of that.
No, there was no record of it. No.
This is a sophistication of the lack of a record system, because although you have a record here, you have another tier that is a removable record. It's a removable record. If it is about politics, either with a small p or a big p.
Just though to maybe caveat that or put my angle on it, if there was an issue that the minister then wanted to follow through on it, that would have appeared in the submission in her response to it.
Of course, if she wished to put it in, yes, the submission. On the other hand, if she didn't, the world would not know that her special advisor had raised it and that she'd thought about it.
Well, Sam, that it's very, very interesting, isn't it? That when you listen then to this system, and just as I listened to that, on the one hand, Dr. Crawford was saying, look, the messages on a post-it note were simply the signal to Arlene Foster, give me a call. On the other hand, he was saying it was political advice. Now, those two are not the same.
That's right. I suppose that the political advice, technically, I suppose, could have come in the phone call, but that, of course, would not have been recorded, so there would have been no written record of that. I think it was a fascinating insight into the culture within this department, the way in which Arlene Foster and her special advisor worked over many years, and he made clear that this was a practice that they had built up between them. The culture, I suppose, of verbal government, things not being written down, meetings not being minuted, that sort of thing, that has come up time and time again in this inquiry. And you can, I mean, it's very easy to see how that could be problematic from the point of view of an inquiry, which is Of course, trying to get to the bottom of what happened at critical points in this this whole process. The judge there and the counsel for the inquiry are clearly saying, and actually in part of the clip which you didn't play, Joseph Aiken said that he hadn't seen any of these post-it notes in any of the hundreds of thousands of pages of documentation which the inquiry has got hold of. So you can understand why there would be a concern that something very significant was in one of those notes, but it wasn't written down for a reason. Now, Dr. Crawford was very clear when he was asked about whether there was anything on one of these notes about lobbying for the RHI scheme or anything of that nature which would be significant to the inquiry's work. He said, no, that certainly was not the case. Arlene Foster,
yeah, but this is the same Dr. Crawford who inappropriately shared confidential information with two of his relatives.
That's right. I think Arlene Foster yesterday expanded on this a little bit when she was asked about it. She initially, again, tried to play it down, said that really it was about him giving her a phone call, said it was a really innocuous thing. She said it was a very innocuous thing to do. And said there was nothing on any post-it notes from my memory that would have caused any concern. But when she was pressed a bit more about what Dr. Crawford said, where he said that there was political advice in some of these post-it notes, she said then, that she said that when he says political, it could be something as mundane, if I could suggest to you, Mr. Schofield, as X will not like this in the party. You know, there were some people who weren't particularly keen on renewable policy and dealing with these issues. So when he says political advice, that's the sort of thing. Now, I suspect that would refer to people like Sammy Wilson, perhaps, who are very well-known climate change skeptics. But that is a very significant change from saying that it was simply about call me. It was actually something that potentially was more significant, but it doesn't exist now. It never entered the system in a formal sense.
I noticed yesterday during the inquiry that Arlene Foster said that, look, the actual layout of these submission documents, there is often not very much room to write things on them. And that's when we were talking about the post-it notes. So if there was not very much room to write anything on the submission, and if that was one of the reasons why there was a post-it note, how do you need much room to say, Arlene, give me a call?
She partially addressed that by saying that she thought it would be inappropriate. She said at one point, I don't think it's appropriate to put on a submission that's going back into the civil service, speak to me. Now, that was suggesting that it wouldn't be appropriate to almost desecrate a ministerial submission with something as trivial as that. So it was put on the post-it note, the post-it note was binned, and the call happened, and that advice was never put into writing. I think if this was being seen in isolation, it would be one thing. I think in the context of all that we know from this inquiry, of all that we know from how Stormont operated, from how the DUP had a particular aversion to the Freedom of Information Act, for instance, I think that there will be at least a suspicion among some people that this was an attempt to not have certain things written down, perhaps for good reason, perhaps because they were politically sensitive, but there was a very conscious attempt to do things over the phone or to do things in a way that wouldn't actually end up in a written piece of paper that could come before a journalist who requests it under the Freedom of Information Act or a court or any other process which would at some point pour over these things in a very fine-tooth comb, as is happening now, of course.
And when you're talking about that context, of course, that context is to remind people that David Stirling, the head of the civil service, we know from recent journalism, recent programming, that there was a culture within the civil service. This is David Stirling's own words, I'm paraphrasing them, but there was a culture within the civil service of not writing things down in order to frustrate the possibility of someone lawfully trying to seek that information through a Freedom of Information request. So that's the context that we're talking about here, that information, in David Stirling's view, was not written down. Let's let the inquiry decide what the motive was for these post-it notes, and we probably shouldn't speculate any further. Let's let Sir Patrick Coughlin and his team do the job there. Sam McBride, thank you very much indeed.